You're listening to a podcast made by University College of Teacher Education, Vienna. Symposium, Transition Inclusion Research, June 9th, 2015.
And I would like to hand over now to Alfred Posamontier, giving the talk, The Transition to Enrichment in Mathematics Instruction, a Key Factor of Successful Teaching.
Can you all hear me? I guess you can. I don't need a loudspeaker. Okay. There's a question that we all need to ask ourselves, and that is, why is mathematics the only subject in the school curriculum that adults are proud to have been weak in during their school years? No one ever says, I wasn't good in biology or English or history, but mathematics, it's a badge of honor. I was lousy in mathematics, and look, I'm successful. The problem is that teachers did not transition, in my mind, to enrichment, to make it interesting. Because when you do something that's not part of the curriculum, that's not prescribed, the teacher brings a certain amount of enthusiasm into the classroom, which normally isn't there. In the United States, some of you may be aware, we have a terrible situation going on right now called the Common Core Standards. The national movement to replace the curriculum with this new system. And the worst thing about it is that there are tests going on throughout the United States, and teachers are being rated by how well their students do on this test. And as a result, there's a lot of teaching to the test, because the teacher knows his job or her job is only as secure as the kids doing well on these tests, going from first grade all the way through the 12th grade. So the transition that I see is a transition from to go from a standard lesson to enrichment. First of all, we revive student interest in mathematics. Second, we generate more enthusiasm for mathematics. In other words, when the teacher is enthusiastic, that is contagious. We expand the student's interest beyond the curriculum. In other words, there are so many things that we can talk about in mathematics that are not taught. And in the last 14 years or so, I've put out a book every year to somehow turn on the general population to a certain new interest in mathematics, with things, nothing beyond algebra and geometry, nothing higher, but there's so much out there that can be interesting, and then people can begin to like math or love mathematics. And students should be interested in pursuing projects to investigate a little bit more. It is where teachers are being asked, and you'll see as we go through this now, where teachers are being asked to maybe take a few minutes every day or every few days to do something that's not in the curriculum, that's not going to be tested. They say, well, how can I waste this time? I need the time, it's precious. No, on the contrary, it's an investment. You give up something to get something back, and what you get back is a much more enthusiastic learner who is going to hopefully be more successful. Okay, there are three types of enrichment, as far as I can see. One is acceleration. Going quicker, moving a student along, it's not very exciting. For a gifted student, it's a nice idea, but for most students, it's not a terrific idea, because a lot is lost along the way. Expansion, where you take a topic that's part of the curriculum and just expand it, do something with that topic that's not in the curriculum but a little bit further on the sides. And the other one is digression, where you take something that can take you to another area of mathematics that's related to the one you have, not the same topic, but where you're going off in another path. The question is, for example, you're dealing with arithmetic or at the elementary school level, and you want to know, where did our numbers come from, these numerals, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on? Where did they come from? A small transition to talk about and look at where our numbers actually came from, the numerals. Why do we call them Hindu-Arabic numerals? You ever wonder about that? I mean, these are the questions you ask students. And it all comes back to the year 1202, where a fellow by the name of, that we call Fibonacci today, wrote a book called Liber Abaci, which was the first time in the Western world that the numerals 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and the zero were first used. Fibonacci, better known as Leonardo of Pisa, grew up in Pisa, and here's a short biography of the fellow. And it, you know, you take a few moments, you're not even taking a minute on this thing, and it's worth it because, oh my God, this really is interesting. He was called Fibonacci in the 1800s when one of the authors felt he came from the family of Bonacci, and so that there is somehow it morphed into the word Fibonacci. He lived in Pisa 1175 to 1250 roughly, and he traveled to the Middle East into the Arab world. He wrote several books that are still available today, and he was the first one to use these numerals. Now, how did he get to these numerals? The interesting thing is he was a kid. His father was sort of a tax collector for Italy on the Barbary coast. And he went there and he intermingled with the Arabs. And the Arabs had these numerals that they got from the Indian world. And the numerals, and the reason he's famous today, basically, is because in chapter 12 of the book Liber Abaci, he has a problem about the regeneration of rabbits. Now, this book, Liber Abaci, is simply a pretty big book that is nothing but a lot of problems and solutions. And this problem we'll talk about in a moment, about the regeneration of rabbits, is very interesting. And it led us to the Fibonacci numbers. Now, I don't expect you to read this now, but I just want you to look at the first, this is the translation of the first, the very, very beginning of his book. He says, I came across these Indian figures, and he wrote them in the reverse order. My speculation is that the reason he wrote them in the reverse order is because the Arabs wrote from right to left, so he probably saw it that way. And he called them Indian figures, because they came from the Hindu world. And then he writes that they also had this thing called a zephyr, meaning the zero. And it was the first time that those numbers were used. And I'll tell you a little funny story, which I did a book on the Fibonacci numbers, and I put this little anecdote in. I don't think I would mention this, except I would mention it here. In the woods around Artaussee, Badaussee, which is about an hour south of Salzburg, in the middle of the woods, there was a mine, a long deserted mine, and on top of the mine said, Anno 1170, 1170, and I said, no way, because they did not have those numerals in 1170. Someone put that on later on, because the numerals were not known until 1202 in the Western world, and they weren't used for at least 50 years after that until they actually got into the swing of it. Anyway, this is what the page looks like, which is, this is the second version. The first version, 1202, is not found, is lost somewhere. He republished it in 1228. So this is from the 1228 version, and this is the problem we're going to be talking about in a moment, where he I'm not going to explain the problem in any great detail, except the problem says, very simply, if you have a pair of rabbits, and it requires 1 month for a pair to mature and then get a second pair, how many rabbits will there be at the end of 1 year? That's the problem. And if you make a chart, you can see how the number of pairs in the first month, you have one pair. The second month, that pair matures, you have another pair. And so on. And you look at the numbers 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8 in this first column here. This first column right here. Those are the Fibonacci numbers. 1, 1, 2, 3, 5. And they are the most famous and important numbers in all of mathematics. And they are used in every aspect of of our lives, and I'll show you in a moment, and also in finance, in whatever. It's just incredible, whether it's coincidence, whether, who knows? It's just an incredible series of numbers. And the way, it's actually what we call a recursive series, because you begin with 1, 1, and you always add the last two to get the next. So 1 plus 1 is 2, and then 1 plus 2 is 3, and so on. Each time you add just the last two to get the next, the last two to get the next. And you have these numbers, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, and so on. Now, these, just to give you, I use these numbers whenever I'm in Europe, if I have to convert miles to kilometers. Because if you, for example, if you're going 13 miles, that's the equivalent of 21 kilometers, the next number up. If you're going, if you look at the number 34 kilometers, that would be 21 miles, always down one, because the ratio of the numbers happens to also be what we call the golden ratio, which is about 1.6, which is the difference between miles and kilometers. Here you have the numbers again, and I mean, it's not very difficult to memorize them, but they're so useful, and you'll see in a moment, if you have a pineapple, and you count the spirals on a pineapple, and there are three different directions for the spirals, you'll find that the number of spirals in every pineapple, always, one spiral, one direction, 5, 8, and 13, and those are Fibonacci numbers. If you look at a pine cone, and you count the spirals on a pine cone, again, the number of spirals will always be Fibonacci numbers. If you look at a sunflower, the spirals in a sunflower, again, Fibonacci numbers. I'll give you another example, which I don't show on here. If you take a tree, let's say a pear tree, and you assume you don't lose any branches, and you look at the first branch down, and then you count the number of branches you have to get to before you get to another branch in the exact same direction as the first one, the number of branches you pass will be a Fibonacci number. It's an incredible number that just has so many applications, and it has also a lot of beauty within it. And it relates to almost every aspect of mathematics. It relates to the Pythagorean theorem, it relates to the golden ratio. It's inexplicable, but it's, and this is how, for example, if you take the sum of the first four Fibonacci numbers, in this case, 1 plus 1 plus 2 plus 3, you get 7, and that's 8 minus 1. And then the sum of the first 5 is 12, which is 13 minus 1. Then 21 minus 1. The first 7 numbers, 34 minus 1. And next to the 8 numbers and so on. And you'll notice that 8, 13, 21, 34, 55 are Fibonacci numbers. So the sums even give you Fibonacci numbers. So there are so many relationships that it's boundless. I mean, as I said, I've written a book about it, so you can do a whole book on just this, and it's just scratching the surface. There are lots of books on this topic. But again, what I'm trying to point out is there's so much in mathematics, which is what I'm hoping to do with you now, to show you that there's fun and excitement that many students never ever see, and probably those of you that didn't like mathematics didn't have this opportunity either. You break up drill, you know, kids have to do arithmetic drill, by doing some unusual things. So let's say they're working just with addition, subtraction, and so on, and you want to do something a little bit different, just a digression. Take the number 666, which some of you may know from the Bible is the number of the devil. What is so unusual about 666? Well, from a mathematical point of view, it's a crazy number. Of course, we know that in the book of Revelation of the New Testament, chapter 13, which is not a very good number either, and you know why 13, there are many reasons why 13 was an unlucky number. At the Last Supper, there were 13 people. And so the number 666 has some unusual things from a historical point of view. But what makes it so unusual? First of all, if you take the Roman numeral version of 666, look what you have there. You have all of the numerals less than 1,000 are used in descending order. The Roman numerals in descending happens to be 666. I'm sure you all know that. Okay. Yeah. Now, if we take the sum of the first 36 natural numbers, 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus all the way up to 36, the sum is 666. Again, but you know, I'm doing this in a very uninteresting way. But as a teacher, and that's what we are all involved in preparing teachers, a teacher has to do this in a very enthusiastic and dramatic way, and that's the way it becomes more effective. And here are some more things about 666. If you take the sum of the squares of the first seven prime numbers, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, you square each one, and the sum again is 666. The sum of the digits, 6 plus 6 plus 6, is equal to the sum of the digits of the primes, prime factors of 666. Interesting. Unusual. But, you know, maybe it's contrived, and who discovered it and who found it? Who knows? Who cares? It's how you show the students. Wow, isn't that amazing? The sum of two consecutive palindromic numbers. Palindromic numbers are numbers that are written backwards and forwards the same. 313 and 353 is equal to 666. And so there are strange occurrences when we insert the sign plus between those numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. One is, notice the numbers are all in order, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Well, this is a little bit contrived, but still, it's fun and it's cute. If we add, notice the numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and just put plus signs where we chose to put plus signs, and we get the answer to be, or you can also do it this way. Again, notice the numerals are in order. Let's take the reverse sequence. Once again, these are fun things that kids say, you know, mathematics isn't so uninteresting. We can do fun things with it. And then when you show kids this, they start to look for patterns themselves, and it's self-motivating. So, you know, it gives mathematics a whole different appearance instead of just drill, 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 and more exercises, and so on. If we take the first 144 decimal places of value of pi, now you know the value of pi, pi is the ratio of circumference to diameter of a circle, and right now we have it to over 3 trillion places. And by the way, in case you're wondering why we have pi to so many places, who cares? You know, 3.14 was good enough for schools. Why do we have to have it to so many places? Well, the reason is very interesting. The reason is that the computer scientists now who create new chips and new computers want to test how fast and how accurate a computer is. So they put an algorithm in that generates pi, and then they see how quickly and how long it takes to get how many places they can get. And we can, of course, relate 66 to the Fibonacci numbers. If we take the first Fibonacci number minus the ninth Fibonacci number plus the 11th Fibonacci number plus the 15th Fibonacci number, we get 666 again. And if we take cubes of Fibonacci numbers, 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6, again we get 666. So, I mean, you're saying, well, this is already overdone. Yes, you don't have to show them all the things. You show some, sometimes show others another time. But to show you all, that there are many different applications that you can use to generate interest. Now, one of the cardinal rule that we would like all children to know is the one thing you cannot do, I usually call it the 11th commandment, you cannot divide by zero. Because if you divide by zero, everything else gets ruined. So we throw out division by zero is not allowed in mathematics anywhere. But how do you prove to someone dramatically that you should not divide by zero? Well, there's a very common and nice little trick, I'll say trick, where you camouflage, you hide the division by zero, and you show something stupid. So let me just show you how you can do that with a convincing demonstration. Now, I'm going to ask you to think about algebra for a minute. I know that some of you haven't seen this in a while. But if we start with, I'm going to do this step by step, so I'll do it nice and slowly. If we assume that A is equal to B, okay? Just remember those two numbers equal to each other. And we multiply both sides by A. On one side, we get A times A. On the other side, we get A times B. The third step is we're now going to subtract B squared from both sides. Okay, just as long as we do the same thing to both sides, okay. Then we're going to factor, and this is correct, this is a factoring. On the left side, we factor the difference between squares. On the other side, we factor out a B from there. And now we divide both sides by A minus B. And so we are left with A plus B is equal to B. And if, since A is equal to B, we now have 2B is equal to B, or 2 equals 1. Wait a minute, 2 equals 1? You can't have 2 equals 1. How can that be? Well, it looks like we did everything correctly. Very slowly, very correctly. We made one mistake. The mistake we made was when we went from step 4 to step 5, we divided both sides by A minus B. And A and B were equal, so A minus B is 0. And you cannot divide by 0. Because if you are able to divide by zero, then one is equal to two, and that's stupid. So this is how you can take the you transition from saying to the class, remember, you're not allowed to divide by zero, and then transitioning to show them why, and it's enriching. And they say, oh, I'll never forget that. That's interesting. And that's the kind of thing that you need to do when you're teaching. For example, we all know the area of a circle is equal to pi r squared. Great. And 99% of the teachers today will say, remember that formula, pi r squared is equal to the area of a circle. But never why. And if you show them maybe something that's a little bit why, they'll get a better feeling instead of being told, remember this, memorize this, doesn't mean anything. So there are many, many ways of doing this. But one way is to break up a circle into 16 parts. Could be into 20 parts, 50 parts. For convenience sake, we made 16 parts. Okay? Then we're going to take those like a pie. We're going to break it up. And we're going to rearrange those 16 parts this way. We just reorganize them. We cut it up. And we organize it that way. And if you look at that and you say, so, well, I have 16. Supposing I had 100. If we had 100 of those slices, then the top level where you have those little curved pieces would be so tiny that it would look like a straight line. And so what we have there is a parallelogram. And the height of the parallelogram is the radius of the original circle. And the straight line on the bottom, the base, is the length of half of the circumference. And so if we take that, we can very quickly show that the area is equal to pi r squared. I'm going a little bit more quickly here, but you see the I'm not asking you to follow every step, but I want you to see how we can show kids who are doing this on a regular basis, for whom this is not a stretch of thinking, that this is a nice little derivation. And again, it's a transition into enrichment. The Pythagorean theorem. You know, there are books written, I've done one, but there are books written about, there's one particular book in English written in 1940 by a fellow by the name of Elisha Loomis. And he wrote 370 different proofs of the Pythagorean theorem. Today there are probably more than 450, but there are so many proofs. And you can I'll do this very quickly. You can actually show the Pythagorean theorem by folding paper. I won't bother you with it now, but we can just do a little paper folding and show that a squared plus b squared equals c squared. But it's also interesting, and especially in the United States, since there are over 400 proofs, to show them that a president of the United States once proved the Pythagorean theorem. Not while he was president, but when he was a member of the House of Representatives. And that was a fellow who he wasn't president very long because he was assassinated, James A. Garfield. He had a lovely, very simple and beautiful proof of the Pythagorean theorem by just breaking up a trapezoid that you see there into three right triangles, and then by just finding the area of the three triangles, he was able to generate the Pythagorean theorem. In the interest of time, I will prepare this as a handout later, but I just want to let you know that you can enrich and you make a small digression to show other proofs of the Pythagorean theorem other than the one that's typically in the textbook. You know, teachers tell the students, a triangle has 180 degrees. Okay, so memorize that, don't forget that. That's not a good way to teach. If you can show how and why we get 180 degrees from a triangle, it's very nice. And you can do it by paper folding. You take a triangle and you fold the pieces down, the top, the three corners, so that you fold this piece down, this piece this way, and this piece this way, you find that these three angles will form right along the straight line at the bottom. And again, this transition to something that's a little bit different, a little bit motivating, gives it to real meaning, but it also gives the teacher an opportunity to be enthusiastic, which oftentimes does not happen when they're so focused on getting the kids prepared for the test, that these digressions really are helpful. This is a cute thing. You know, math teachers are precise, and they tell students, you have to prove something before you can accept it. You always have to prove it. You have to make sure that this is correct. Well, I'll show you something that's really, it's entertaining, but it's also surprising. There was a conjecture, a guess, that every odd number greater than one can be expressed as the sum of a power of two and a prime number. Okay, well, let's take a look. If you look at this list, you see here that up to, well, take three. Three is 2 to the 0 power plus 2. 5 is 2 to the first power plus 3. And you can see going up, 51 is 2 to the fifth power plus 19. It works. Gee, that looks like it's really true. You get to 125, and all of the first 125 cases works. You think, wow, that looks like it works for everything. Wrong, because 127 doesn't work. And this is a lovely little example of where you can show students a transition into something that demonstrates for them the need to prove something, that it's not just something that looks like it works. It works, it works, it works. Oh, it must work for everything. Not true. I mean, there are so many examples where something works and then all of a sudden maybe 100 cases down, it doesn't work. And those are very important messages that you give students as they move along in their development. This is, again, I'm going to do this quickly. This is a something that is mind-boggling. And it, again, shows students how mathematics brings you to another level. And that transition is really an important part of teaching mathematics. This is a situation that most people find incredible. Supposing you take a rope around the Earth, say the equator, very tight. The rope is tight along the equator. And then you're going to take a piece of rope 1 yard, which is almost a meter long, and you're going to make the rope a little longer by 1 meter. Now, it's 25,000 miles long, right? And now you're making it just about that much longer, right? So it's not tight anymore, it's loose. And the question is, supposing we make it loose all the way around the equator, could a mouse fit under there? You say, oh my God, it must be that much off the thing, because you add 1 yard to this long 25,000 mile stretch. And you say, well, how can we figure that out? And it brings meaning to what they've been learning all along. I won't go into too much detail, but it's absolutely the very simplest application in geometry of using the circumference of a circle. And you just make a diagram where you have the small radius, small r, a big radius, now the longer rope. And when you do the calculation, and you can see it here, I'll give you this later, I'll have this available to you somehow. But you see that when you do this this is very simple if you're learning this, the difference in the circumferences is 5.7 inches, which is about that much. A mouse can fit under that. Can you imagine that much space between the Earth and that rope, and all you did was increase it by that much? It's totally counterintuitive. It's something you'd never imagine, but it's true. And again, it gives that transition, gives meaning to mathematics that most kids don't have. All they know is doing tests. This is a very, you know, we teach in the last 20, 25 years, the topic of probability has come into the curriculum very gradually. And kids learn it, and they taught you, this is the way you do this, it's automatic. But there has to be also a deeper understanding. And this would be a digression, which again, a transition to another way of thinking. And this is this is a very popular thing. It began in the United States with a TV show called Let's Make a Deal. This was a regular television show, black and white TV, a half hour long, and and the moderator's name was Monty Hall, Canadian guy who was the moderator of that show. Very, very popular. And it had an audience of a lot of people, you know, every day. And then they had three contestants on stage. And at one point, and by the way, this is called the Monty Hall problem, and there are books written about this problem because there were so many arguments among mathematicians as to what the right way to do this was. So you'll see in just a moment. But in a way that you can show students, it gives so much power to the notion of probability. There were three doors on stage, and there was a goat behind each of two doors, and a car behind another door. And a contestant, somebody was called up to the stage and was asked to pick one door. Okay? So there's a guy coming up to the stage, and let's say he picks door number three. Now, here's the important thing. Monty Hall knew where the car was. He knew where the goats were, he knew where the car was. If he didn't, this doesn't even work. So he knew where they were. And so what he did was, He exposed one goat. He knew where the goat was. He said, I will show you one door. And at that point, there was a pause. And he asked the contestant, would you like to stay at the door you originally chose, which was door number 3, or would you rather switch to door number 1? And at that point, there was a pause. And the audience would yell, switch, stick, and they were screaming and so on, and he's sitting there and know what to do, and so on and so forth. And the question now is, what's the right strategy? What's the best strategy? And this was something that mathematicians argued for years. Articles were written about. The New York Times covered this article, covered this topic. It was, and as I say, there were books written just about this one question. Well, how do you show students, how do you convince them? So I thought of a way that I think is convincing. I mean, I would, this is more for students. I say a problem-solving technique that we use in mathematics, and we use it in everyday life as well, is how to use extremes. It's a great problem-solving technique. For example, we use it when we say, should I do this or should I do that? Now, in the worst case scenario, this or that will happen. That's an extreme, and that's when we use extremes in everyday life. But let's take a look here. Supposing instead of 3 doors, we have 1,000 doors. Now you have to follow along, otherwise you're not going to be happy at the end. So just, if any of you don't agree with what I'm saying, you have to raise your hand so we stop and make sure you all agree. Otherwise, at the end, you're not going to be happy. Okay, 1,000 doors, there they are. Now, as before, our contestant is lazy, so he goes to the first door. He picks door number 1,000. Now, my question, is it likely or unlikely that the car is behind door number 1,000? Unlikely. Very unlikely. Much more likely than it's in all the others, correct? Somewhere. So, how unlikely? Chances that the car is behind door number 1,000 is 1 out of 1,000. Terrible odds, terrible. Okay, the chance that it's behind one of the other doors is 999 out of 1,000. Very likely. So what we should really do at this point is we know that at all those doors from 1 to 999, we're going to put an L, likely, very likely. The one that he chose gets a U, unlikely. Okay? Now, Monty Hall knows where the goats are, and he leaves one door closed, and he asks the contestant, would you rather go to door number 1 or door number 1,000? Well, do you want to go to the U or the L? The L. And so the answer is, and eventually mathematicians have agreed, that the strategy, the best strategy, is to switch and not stay with the original door. But the the nice thing about this is the kids love it. It's, oh my God, now really? And you probably have to discuss it a little bit more than I'm doing with you, but the whole notion of probability gets a new life when you transition to something that's not in the curriculum. So this is the transitioning to enriched mathematics can be entertaining. The peculiarities are amazing, and there are endless such. Most concepts are interrelated, as you can see, and that's very entertaining in itself. There are amazements and surprises beyond anything you can imagine. And above all, enrichment is something that we must train teachers from the first grade to the 12th grade always to transition to. It's an investment.